Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, welcome to our series on the most important battles in the Civil War, the 10 most important battles specifically. We're on number 9. Last episode, we began, and we were looking at Atlanta and the March to the Sea, Sherman's March to the Sea. It's all grouped together, so we thought we would make a two-parter out of this. In the last episode, we ended with the fall of Atlanta, the resounding Union victory, not so much resounding in numbers, although they definitely bested the Confederates, but in terms of morale, it was critical for the Union. This has direct impact on Northern morale. More importantly, this has direct impact on the election of 1864, which for years both sides were looking to as a bellwether of whether or not Union victory would be possible because their morale might be sapped so much. So let's start there. And then after we look at the election of 1864, we'll look at our friend General Hood and his march into Tennessee after he is forced to leave Atlanta. He's derided as one of the most ruthlessly and recklessly aggressive generals in the Confederacy in the Civil War, and we'll see how he fares. Finally, we'll look at Sherman's March to the Sea. So, James, let's start things off with the election of 1864.
Yes, it's important that even though this is not a battle, it's not a military event, we've talked about before how closely linked that the political and the military parts of the Civil War are connected. So I want to back up a little in time. We talked about the fall of Atlanta, which happened in early September of 1864, but let's back up to the summer. Let's pretend that we don't know Atlanta is going to fall into Union hands. If you go back to the summer of 1864, the Union war effort seemed to be going terribly. Sherman was stalled out in front of Atlanta. We saw earlier how Hood had kind of checked his advance with some of these attacks that he did, even though they were turned out to be not well advised, let's say. They were very costly for the Confederacy. And Grant had been fighting Lee for a couple months, and he had lost 60,000 men in 1 month. And he was stuck in front of Petersburg, Virginia. And other Union efforts had failed as well. We talked about Banks was trying to invade Texas and didn't work, as usually was the case. And Benjamin Butler and Franz Sigel had jobs to do. And not, I hate to spoil this, but they're also going to blow it. So these things are not going well. This great five-part plan that we talked about in the last episode that Grant had hoped to unleash on the Confederacy, it looked like all five parts of it were complete failures. There was a great amount of opposition to Lincoln in the North, even among Republicans. You know, we forget that sometimes. We tend to think that the Republican Party was totally on board with Lincoln and his program, but that's not the case. Lincoln was assaulted on all sides. You know, the Democrats thought he was too tough on the South. There were a lot of Republicans to his right that thought he was too wimpy and too soft on the South, too indulgent of these commanders that were failing right and left. Now, Lincoln could have suspended the elections. Almost every other country in the world in this kind of a situation had done that, but he chose not to. This is what he said. This is a nice quotation. He said, "We cannot have free government without elections. And if the rebellion could force us to forego or postpone a national election, it might fairly claim to have already conquered and ruined us." So That's really statesmanlike of Lincoln. Lincoln gets a lot of criticism for some of the things he did. He cracked down on civil rights in some areas. He threw people in jail without trial. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus. But he doesn't suspend the elections. Here, again, he says, in essence, if I can paraphrase this quote, if we don't have this election, then we've already lost. So I think that's pretty impressive. This is the first time the U.S. had ever had an election in the middle of a war. And it was the first time in history any nation had had one in the midst of a civil war. As far as I know, now I don't know every single election and every war and every, I don't know all of history. So if somebody listening can think of an example and to correct me on that, then please do send an angry email to Scott.
I'm used to it by now, so I know when to hit delete. That's when I see
right.
The subject line.
But as far as I know, no country had ever had an election in the midst of a civil war. All right, so let's talk about the radical Republicans, the Republicans I mentioned to the right of Lincoln who thought he was too soft on the South, too wimpy. They wanted to dump him for John C. Fremont. We've talked about Fremont several times. Well, I want to take any time to talk about him, but let's just say he was more of an abolitionist, more of a radical than Lincoln, or even Salmon P. Chase. Salmon P. Chase was Lincoln's very own Secretary of the Treasury. So Salmon P. Chase is actually kind of hoping maybe he'll get nominated and they'll dump Lincoln because he thought he knew what to do better than Lincoln did. But neither one of these efforts come to anything. They both eventually fail, and most Republicans eventually do rally behind Lincoln. The Republicans do something kind of shrewd in this election. They change their name. You know, we tend to think of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the two-party system, which we've had for a long, long, long time, over 150 years. We think of it as something timeless and eternal, but it actually wasn't. We have to remember that at this time in 1864, the Republican Party was still brand new. It was 10 years old, which is new for a political party. So they changed their name to the National Union Party. See, that's a stroke of propagandic genius because they're saying we're the party of the Union. We're the party that's loyal. Just by that very name, they're accusing Democrats of being disloyal and against the Union. The sitting vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, who hadn't really had much of a role in the government, he was dumped. They got rid of him. The Republican Party did. I must say that at this point, the presidential candidates did not choose their vice presidents like we see today. The parties had conventions and they chose them. So really, Lincoln didn't get much of a say in this. I don't think he had a problem with this. There's a strategic reason they do this. Hannibal Hamlin didn't do anything wrong necessarily, but they picked Andrew Johnson from Tennessee. And as we're going to see, he's going to have a big future. Just to refresh our listeners on Andrew Johnson's background, Johnson was a Southerner. He was kind of like Lincoln in that he was raised in poverty and he educated himself. He read a lot. He studied. He became a lawyer. Became a successful lawyer and then worked his way up through the political ranks. He had been governor of Tennessee. He had been a senator from Tennessee at the time of the Civil War's outbreak. And he was the only Southern senator who did not resign from the Senate and throw their weight behind the Confederate effort. He hated secession. He was radical unionist. Now, he was not an abolitionist by any stretch of the imagination. No. But he
owned slaves, didn't he?
He did own slaves. That's correct. And as we're gonna see after the Civil War, we're not really going to cover Reconstruction, but a lot of our listeners may know that he's not going to be in favor of helping out the freed slaves later. But at this time, Lincoln wants to reward him. He wants to tell the nation, look, I've got a Southerner on my ticket, or not so much Lincoln, but the party. I think Lincoln certainly was in favor of this too, but it was really the party wanted to have a united image. They're trying to get Tennessee back into the Union. So this is sending a message to the rest of the country. You know, we're not a bunch of radical abolitionist, extreme radical Republicans. We've got a Southerner. He was a Democrat, by the way. So they're trying to reach across party lines and build unity. Lincoln had a famous saying. He said to the voters, don't change horses in midstream. Again, another very Lincoln-esque kind of quote, which gets used later in American political history. But the idea is, why would you want to get a different president right in the middle of a war? That would be a terrible thing to do. Well, the Democrats, of course, completely disagreed with that. They wanted to change horses in midstream, and the horse they wanted to run the country was our old friend, our beloved, not former general George McClellan. George McClellan had always been a Democrat. He has always been critical of the way Lincoln ran the war. McClellan promised to make peace with the South, and Democrats based their hopes for victory on the desire for peace among Northerners. McClellan was a war Democrat. We talked about the two different kind of Democrats. He wanted to win the war, but he didn't want to conquer the South. He didn't want to free the slaves. He didn't want to remake the South in the image of the North. Nothing like that. He just wanted to bring the war to an he wanted peace with honor, basically. But the platform was a peace platform. It had been written by the peace Democrats who just wanted to shut it down right now. Just let's just end it and go back to the way things were before the war. And as I mentioned,
Oh, the irony.
I know. Yeah. I mean, people don't understand sometimes that you can't go back to the past. You know, sometimes you hear that today. Oh, if we could just be like things were in the 80s or the 50s or something. No, that's you can't. And especially when the war had changed everything so radically.
Well, I have to ask two questions. First of all, does the press have a field day making fun of McClellan, the former general, for having to be this peace activist? Second, are his political campaigns as slow as his military campaigns?
Well, I'll answer the second one first. The candidates back in this day did not go out and campaign themselves. It was deemed as beneath their dignity. You were supposed to not want to be president. Candidates were supposed to say, well, if the country wants me, then yes, I'm going to do it. But I'm not out there begging people to make me president, which, of course, was an act. It was a farce. But so McClellan himself didn't go out and do stump speeches and tour the country like candidates do today and have for quite some time. People did it for him. So, I mean, I guess you could say it was slow in that he didn't really campaign at all.
Just like his military campaigns.
Exactly. Do nothing. But at least with the political campaign, he was doing what he was supposed to do. And what was the other question? I've already forgotten.
Oh, nothing. Just the irony of the military general.
The Republican press certainly made a lot of fun of him, but the Democratic press just said, hey, this is our hope. This man will make peace. He knows what it's like to lead an army. Lincoln didn't know anything about that. McClellan, if McClellan had had, it's kind of weird to argue that when you look at his record. But he was a war Democrat running with a peace Democrat platform, which made it very awkward for him. He didn't really like all the planks of the platform, but they just swept that under the rug for the sake of hopefully winning. All right. We had seen that there'd been a lot of union, if not disasters, then just kind of stalling out and not winning, if not losing. Lincoln felt sure in the summer of 1864 that he would lose. This is what he wrote. He said, "This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterward." So that's very magnanimous of Lincoln. And Lincoln says, number one, I don't think I'm going to win. And if I do not win, I'm going to help the new president to save the Union. I'm going to do everything I can. So that, again, that's very mature of Lincoln. I don't think McClellan would have done that. One interesting thing about this election in 1864 is that many U.S. soldiers were allowed to take trains to the polls and vote. You didn't really have absentee balloting like we do today. So, today, if you're a soldier and you're stationed, let's say, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Germany, South Korea, wherever, you can just absentee vote. But that didn't happen for the most part back then. So you had to actually go home and vote in your home district. And it was very shrewd of Lincoln to allow these soldiers, because, again, there wasn't always a lot of fighting going on. And when there's no fighting going on, they're just sitting around. So send them home, let them vote, and bring them back real quick. They were able to do that because they had so many trains, and so much railroad track. And it was determined later they were able to, in a lot of places, count the soldiers' vote separate. And 80% of soldiers who voted for Lincoln. So that's pretty amazing when you consider if these are guys that if they vote against Lincoln, they probably are going to get to go home pretty soon. If they vote for Lincoln, the war is probably going to continue for a while longer. But they vote for Lincoln anyway. I think that really speaks a lot for Lincoln and his leadership, that he inspired people to vote for him, even though doing so might be against their own, what would you say, their own personal interest, their own physical body in some cases. All right. Just prior to the election, Union forces won several victories. We talked about, of course, the fall of Atlanta, and we'll talk about some others later. And this really is what put Lincoln over the top, and he gets reelected. Lincoln wins 212 electoral votes to McClellan's 21. So it's wow. A wipeout in the Electoral College. It's not even close.
That's Reagan Mondale territory.
It really is. It ranks up there with some of the greatest electoral landslides in our history. It's just amazing to think it wasn't even close. Even though we're in this war, even though people probably knew if they voted for McClellan, it would bring the war to an end. But they didn't want to do it the way the Democrats wanted to do. They wanted total victory. You know, I think most Northern people were, by this point, they were kind of fed up with the South. They were angry with the South, and they wanted to punish them. Not everybody felt this way, but obviously quite a few did. Lincoln won all Union states except three: Kentucky, which was a border state, still a slave state at this point; New Jersey, which was McClellan's home state. It's kind of bad if you don't vote for your home guy, right? And Delaware, which has 10 people, so it doesn't. So Lincoln wins, and yeah. Lincoln, it's a referendum on the war and the Union war effort, which, as we've seen, was far from perfect. I mean, the Union had so many screw-ups, but they're starting finally to get their act together, and the American people reward Lincoln for that.
Well, he's able to effectively harness the Northern anger against the South, and then perhaps the crowning achievement of his abilities as a statesman is after the war's end, he pleads with them not to take further revenge on the South and does whatever he can to heal the rift, although the wound is gaping and some argue that it hasn't ever fully healed. But let's jump back into the narrative, because we left off at an interesting point in the last episode with General John Bell Hood failing to defend Atlanta, but his story is not over yet. So we're going to see him march into Tennessee. Hey everyone, want to take a short break in this episode on our narrative on the Civil War. I want to mention a way how you can help support this show, and you can do so by saving big with a great new product from a company called Candid. Candid basically takes all of the misery out of adult orthodontia. There's millions of people at any given time in the United States who have wire braces, and there are many, many millions more who should be wearing retainers and aren't and need a tooth straightening solution. Well, Candid is a company that makes it possible to get tooth straightening without ever having to visit an orthodontist, without ever having to leave your home, and to get it all done much more cheaply and in a fraction of the time of conventional orthodontia. The way it works is that Candid sends a modeling kit to your home so you can take impressions of your teeth. After you send back your impressions with some photos of your teeth, a network of orthodontists reviews your case and provides you with a 3D preview of what your treatment will look like. After you receive your 3D preview, it's up to you if you want to go forward or not with a tooth aligner treatment plan. And when you get your treatment plan, it results in straighter and brighter teeth in an average of 6 months and can cost thousands of dollars less than braces. And again, no office visits are needed. Everything is delivered to your home. You can take advantage of Candid's risk-free modeling kit guarantee. And when you use my dedicated link, candidco.com/unplugged, you'll save 25% off your modeling kit. That's candidco.com/unplugged to get 25% off the price of your modeling kit. candidco.com/unplugged.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
What's happening with our friend Hood?
Hood, as he typically did, comes up with a very bold strategy. He was not a calm and methodical and plotting general by any stretch of the imagination. So he decides, instead of just backing up south of Atlanta and continuing to try to stop Sherman, he's going to go again on the offensive. He's going to go behind Sherman, march around Sherman's army, get in his rear. And he thought this would force Sherman to turn around and go back and go after Hood, lest his supply line be broken. We'd seen this happen in the East several times, where The Confederate Army makes a bold movement, and the Union has to go chase them down. Jefferson Davis approves this plan. Davis and Hood hoped the campaign might even result in the recapture of Tennessee and possibly even Kentucky, or at least part of the states. At this point, that was a pipe dream, but hey, give them points for thinking big, right? For being bold.
They're always a scrappy little group of underdogs, so they have to be optimistic.
Yeah, and again, we've talked about this before. In some ways, the Confederacy had to be bold. They had to be aggressive and roll the dice. I mean, it worked for Robert E. Lee so many times in the past. The Confederacy couldn't afford to just sit there and get pounded on and pounded on and pounded on and end up like the Confederate Army in Vicksburg, which basically hunkered down and went into a totally defensive mode and ended up getting captured, 30,000 people. They had to be aggressive. So the Confederates set out in September. They moved north instead of south. Hood, again, is hoping that Sherman will come chase after him. Well, guess what Sherman did?
I think that he would chase after him, yeah. But or not.
He actually doesn't. Sherman doesn't play.
What?
Yeah, Sherman says, yeah, you go ahead. That's fine, buddy. Just knock yourself out. I got other plans. Sherman didn't play by other people's rules. This is not a Burnside or a Hooker or a McClellan. Sherman just ignores Hood's movement. He does send George Thomas and his army of 60,000, probably down to about 50,000 now, but he sends Thomas to go north and to stop Hood. But he instead proposes to Lincoln and Grant to go on a destructive march to the coast, living off the land. And he said famously, where a million people live, my army won't starve. So he wants to just really punch the South and hit them where it hurts, hit them in the gut, so to speak, literally take their food source away, as well as tear up rail lines and other types of war supplies. So again, he sends Thomas to the north, to Nashville, to stand in Hood's way. And Hood marches towards Nashville. He's got 40,000 men. Thomas has 50,000. That pretty soon grows to 60,000. And again, that's the thing. That's where that northern population advantage comes in. The north doesn't have that much trouble coming up. I mean, sometimes they had trouble getting people to sign up, but once they had the draft, which, you know, that wasn't perfect either, but it wasn't that hard for the Union to scrounge up 10,000 guys. For the Confederacy, that was almost impossible. Hood's soldiers are marching north. They're heading toward Nashville. They're not equipped with cold weather gear. It gets really cold in Tennessee during the winter. They're running low on food. They're not in a position to do this invasion, this attack, but Hood doesn't care. He wants to give it a try anyway. He's gambling. So he gets close to Franklin, Tennessee, which is south of Nashville. And one evening, the temperature gets down to freezing, but both armies... This is a note from another battle that I forgot to take out. Although there was a lot of freezing. This is something from I think it was from Chickamauga. I can't remember, but there is a lot of there's the issue of the cold, which is definitely going to hurt the Confederacy more than hurts the Union. The Union Army is very well supplied. All right, so back to the actual campaign. Hood, as I mentioned, arrives at Franklin. There's 28,000 Federals under Schofield. Schofield, remember, was one of the other army commanders. He had also been sent north. I didn't mention that earlier. But Schofield's got 28,000 guys, and Hood doesn't want to wait until the troops are in place. Hood is in a hurry. He wants to strike quickly. He doesn't have all of his guys. He has 18,000 against 28,000 Federals who were dug in across 2 miles of open ground. Did I mention that? No, I didn't, but so it's starting to look like Pickett's charge, and it's going to have similar results. It's an absolute disaster. This is called the Battle of Franklin. 6,000 Confederates are casualties, including 12 generals. 12 wow. Generals, including Patrick Claiborne. We mentioned him earlier. He was an Irish immigrant who became a Confederate general. Very talented commander. He was one of these cream rising to the top kind of guys, but now he's cut out of the picture. The Federals had only 2,300 casualties, and they just said, no problem, we'll back up to Nashville. So, again, let me sum up those numbers. Hood, the Confederate commander, loses 6,000 men. The Federalists lose just over 2,000. Hood continues on to Nashville. He shakes it off. He says, eh, no big deal. And he camps outside of Nashville. On December 15th, Thomas takes the battle to him. He attacks again on the second day. He drives the rebels back. This is called, surprise, surprise, the Battle of Nashville. It's a freezing rainstorm. Hood retreats into Alabama. He's absolutely crushed. The Confederates take an awful lot of casualties. And by the time Hood has to retreat from Tennessee, not just from Nashville, but from the whole state of Tennessee, he's down to 15,000 soldiers. So absolute, complete, and utter disaster for the Confederates. They started with 40,000 when they marched from Atlanta heading north toward Nashville. And by the time this campaign is over, they're down to 15,000. So well done, General Hood. You just had more than half of your army wiped out. And this ends the war for Tennessee, and this ends Hood's career. Hood is drummed out of the army after this. And rightly so. It was just, there's no putting a silver lining on this black cloud. It was a complete Confederate disaster and a total Union victory.
Yeah, I wonder in the annals of Confederate lore, does Hood occupy a low circle of hell like a Pemberton or those types of people?
Well, not so much, because Hood has a mixed record. Hood was a terrific brigade commander. Okay, so when he was commanding 3,000 or 4,000 guys, he was one of the best. He commanded what was called the Texas Brigade, which was made up almost entirely of people from the state of Texas, of course. And then when he was promoted to a division commander, now commanding, you know, maybe 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 guys or so, maybe 12, probably more like 8 or 10 in the Confederacy. When he was commanding a division, he did very well. That would have been like at Gettysburg. He did well. So he, a mixed record. Hood was just a guy who had risen about as high as he should have. He was not the right kind of person for an army command. He did really well at lower levels. You know, sorry to bring out baseball again. Hey, everybody, take a drink when I say baseball. go back and listen to the last episode, and you may be falling on the floor before you finish it. But you know, in baseball, you have guys that tear it up at single A, double A, triple A. They're great players. They're one of the best. They make the all-star team in triple A, but you bring them up to the majors, and they just can't handle it. And that's what happened with Hood. Hood was great at the lower levels, but just, you know, he was too aggressive, too foolhardy to be an army commander. So that for that reason, he has a mixed legacy, not a completely negative one.
It's always a difficult balance between being aggressive enough to get victory despite a numerical disadvantage in a way that Stonewall Jackson, Nathan Bedford Forrest, and Lee can manage, but not be so aggressive that you're exploiting the inherent weakness that your army already has. Yeah. And there's less and less margin for error. There's less and less wiggle room to be able to effectively march that line as the war effort goes on.
Yeah, you can blame Davis too. Why did he promote this guy? But I mean, you could make the same charge against Lincoln. Lincoln promoted a lot of really crappy guys, but it's because, I mean, crappy at the high level. But you don't know that. You see a general who is really kicking some serious butt at the brigade level or the division level, and there's no reason to think that they won't be just as good when you raise them up.
There's a lot of post-game analysis that James and I will do in a wrap-up episode, because these questions are not resolved at all. There are many who will say the Confederate effort was doomed from the start. Others say that at different points it could have succeeded, years into the battle, in fact, and there are some that would almost argue close to the end, maybe not this far, but there are many points where the Confederacy could have won, and it's not that clear. It's clear in hindsight, but for the people on the ground, there were legitimate fears that the Confederacy would be able to marshal enough forces and enough support among the population to win. Mm-hmm. But we're going to see something that is going to be a major, if not the nail in the coffin of Confederate hopes, that is Sherman's march to the sea. So, James, walk us through his plan and saying that if this land can feed 1 million people, we can live off of it. So what does that look like on the ground?
Yes. Okay. So Sherman had, he'd had about 100,000, maybe down to 80,000 or so after some of the sparring with Johnston and Hood outside of Atlanta. He sent Thomas and Schofield back to Tennessee, and now that leaves him with about 60,000, maybe 62,000 to be exact. And General Hood, John Bell Hood, does Sherman a huge favor by just completely evacuating the premises and leaving Georgia wide open. There's almost nobody to oppose Sherman. There's just a handful of cavalry. There's some Georgia militia, which is mainly old men and young boys. So Sherman is going to be unstoppable. There's no serious opposition to his plan. Grant orders him to clear the country ahead of him, and he also orders him to form black regiments when he encountered enough former slaves. Now, he didn't do this. Sherman was not in favor of African-American soldiers. He was everybody at this point was somewhat racist, but Sherman was more racist than average. He just didn't think that blacks could fight, so he didn't do that to his detriment. But Sherman says he's going to move through Georgia, smashing things to the sea. He said, I can make the march and I can make Georgia howl. And he wanted to not only damage the South's capacity to make war, but also to inflict psychological damage. And that's very important. He's not just trying to destroy the Confederacy's ability to feed itself and to equip itself, but also to demoralize them so much, to make it to where they just think resistance is futile and just give up. All right, so there's a psychological element that's creeping into it as well. In early November, Sherman orders all civilians out of Atlanta, and then he burns much of the city, what was left. A lot of it had already been burned by the Confederates, but he burns a lot of the rest of it, and about 40% of the city is destroyed. And Sherman, to this day, is vilified by some people for that. Hood protested. Hood was, of course, marching toward Tennessee. He found out about this, and he protested, and Sherman replied, if the people raise a howl against my barbarity and cruelty, I will answer that war is war and not popularity seeking. If they want peace, they and their relatives must stop the war. And the mayor of Atlanta also protested, and Sherman told him, war is cruelty and you cannot refine it. That's a famous quote. In another letter, he makes the famous statement, war is hell. So Sherman's basically saying, if you don't want me to burn things and destroy things, then surrender. Stop. You know, you guys started this. I'm trying to bring it to a conclusion. So Sherman is totally not apologetic. He says war, and he's one of the first to grasp the concept of total war, that war is not just something that two professional armies go fight and nobody else notices what's going on. War has got to affect the entire population. All right, let me move on just a little, and then we'll talk about it. Let's see. On November 16th, Sherman's army steps off. They leave Atlanta. They march westward toward the Atlantic coast. His orders were to forage for food and not to destroy civilian property. Although, I must say, in all fairness, this was not often obeyed, and Sherman didn't always try real hard to enforce that. There was a lot of looting and theft and destruction of civilian property, despite the fact that that wasn't supposed to happen. The army also destroyed much, but not all, of what they encountered. There's a common myth that Sherman's army destroyed everything in its path, like a band of locusts in the Old Testament or something. That's not true. They didn't destroy everything, but they did destroy a lot. Sherman himself estimated that he did $100 million in damage. $100 million, it would be a lot today, but when you can consider it, that's like today, like $1 back then is like 15 today. So that would be like 1.5 billion, I guess, if my math is correct. So anyway, yeah, it was very, very destructive.
Yeah. And I'd like to look at some of his field orders on how do you handle this foraging, because this is a question here. Did he advocate total destruction? This is something that you see in the myth of the lost cause, the Southern narrative of the Civil War, the school of thought that emerges in the decades after the Civil War by Southern historians, that what Sherman does today, you could compare it to a Red Army marching through Eastern Europe and going to Germany, where the Red Army essentially rapes almost every woman they come across and shoots men or sends them to the gulag. Or is it something like the Mongols or in medieval warfare, where when an army successfully breaks a siege, The soldiers are essentially given 3 days to ransack and pillage, to enslave people they come across, to loot and steal, because this forms the backbone of a lot of payment you would give to a soldier in the Middle Ages. Is that what's happening here, or is it more of a coordinated plan strategy? And I want to read these field orders just to see what Sherman is thinking. And like James mentioned, these orders don't convey the full reality of what's happening, because there are many soldiers who simply ignore the orders and go for a free-for-all. So you could take it that way. But here are just a few of his orders. One of them: the army will forage liberally on the country during the march. To this end, each brigade commander will organize a good and sufficient foraging party under the command of one or more discreet officers, who will gather, near the route traveled, corn or forage of any kind, meat of any kind, vegetables, cornmeal, or whatever is needed by the command, aiming at all times to keep in the wagons at least 10 days' provisions for the command and 3 days' forage. Soldiers must not enter the dwellings of the inhabitants or commit any trespass, but during a halt or a camp, they may be permitted to gather turnips, apples, and other vegetables, and to drive in stock to their camp, and to drive in stock of their camp. To regular foraging parties must be instructed the gathering of provisions and forage at any distance from the road traveled. So don't break into people's homes, he's saying, but you can kind of have a free-for-all in farms. Other factors, too, to army commanders. To army corps commanders alone is entrusted the power to destroy mills, houses, cotton gins, and for them, this general principle is laid down. In districts and neighborhoods where the army is unmolested, no destruction of such property should be permitted. But should guerrillas or bushwhackers molest our march, or should the inhabitants burn bridges, obstruct roads, or otherwise manifest local hostility, then army commanders should order and enforce a devastation more or less relentless according to the measure of such hostility. So you get wiggle room if you get hostility from the locals, and I'm sure there were commanders who they got an inch and they took a mile.
Yeah, I think that was interpreted pretty loosely in some cases. Hostility from the locals could be like if you said, hey, don't take my farm. Oh, look, there's hostility, so we're going to burn it.
Right. Or they look at you skunk-eyed and you're going to pillage their house and go for it. And then one other thing here, I thought this is an interesting order, and I'll just mention where they try to discriminate between the rich and the poor Southerners they encounter. As for horses, mules, wagons, etc., belonging to the inhabitants, the cavalry and artillery may appropriate freely and without limit, discriminating, however, between the rich, who are usually hostile, and the poor or industrious, usually neutral or friendly. Foraging parties may also take mules or horses to replace the jaded animals of their trains, or to serve as pack mules for the regiments or brigades. In all foraging, of whatever kind, the parties engaged will refrain from abusive or threatening language and may, where the officer in command thinks proper, give written certificates of the facts, but no receipts, and they will endeavor to leave with each family a reasonable portion for their maintenance. Yeah, I'm sure that's really kept
reasonable them, so. Portion.
Yeah, so there's a lot of wiggle room. So I guess Sherman is trying to make this as orderly as possible and not have it be a Mongolian-style pillage of the land where everyone gets whatever they can lay their hands on. But there's sufficient discretion that if a commander wants to, he can really go to town. So that's the parameters that we're seeing here.
Yeah, a lot of soldiers wrote home that they were eating the best they'd ever eaten in their lives. You know, I mean, you think about army rations. They're famous for being terrible, and the Civil War is no exception. They would have oftentimes when they had meat, it would be stale, sometimes even rotten. It would just be not very good, rancid in some cases. The vegetables were in short supply always. A lot of what they ate was called hardtack, which was a really thick cracker, very, very hard, hence the name hardtack. I've actually had some before. It's like eating a brick, a small brick. But now, I mean, think about it. They're having beef, they're having bacon, they're having chicken, they're having vegetables, just whatever they can get, milk and butter and cheese. And there's a party style atmosphere. It's like this one long party. And I'm sure there was plenty of alcohol to be found along the way too.
Oh yes. The hard cider makes its appearance.
All right. Shall we continue the march?
Let's.
All right, so they're marching along, and eventually they reach Milledgeville, which at the time was the capital of Georgia. It was not Atlanta at this time. And they go into part of Sherman's army, some of his soldiers, they go into the state capitol and they held a mock legislative session. And during this session, they formally repealed the ordinance of secession. So that's kind of funny. They officially bring Georgia back to the Union. Of course, that doesn't have any authority, but it's fun for the guys. And as I mentioned along the way, they meet with very little resistance. And finally, on December 21st, they enter the city of Savannah on the coast. And Sherman wires Lincoln, and he makes the famous statement, another one of these great Shermanisms. He says, "I beg to present you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah with guns and also about 25,000 bales of cotton." And Lincoln said, "This is one of the best Christmas presents I've ever received." So the army had marched 250 miles. They picked up several thousand former slaves. And as we mentioned, they'd done $100 million approximately worth of damage in the money of the time, which is an incredible, incredible amount of damage. One Union soldier wrote home and he said, "We had a gay old campaign. We destroyed all we couldn't eat. We stole all their Negroes, burned their cotton and gins, spilled their sorghum, burned and twisted their railroads, and raised hell generally." That's a great quote. Dr. Gary Gallagher quotes that in all of his lectures on this, and it's just really sums up what happened. They're having fun, and it's, you think about it, they're almost never being shot at, so that's kind of a nice perk as well. Now, as I alluded to earlier, a lot of runaway slaves had attached themselves to Sherman's army, and he wasn't real wild about this. He didn't really know what to do with them. Sherman actually met with some black leaders to seek their advice on what to do with the former slaves who had joined the army, at least unofficially joined it. And they told Sherman that owning their own land was the best way for them to be truly free. So Sherman does something really radical, really not in his character. I mentioned earlier how he was not an abolitionist, didn't want to see the widespread end of slavery necessarily, but despite that, he issues Field Order 15, and this confiscates 400,000 acres of land, and he divides it into 40-acre plots and gives each plot to a black family. This is where the phrase 40 acres and a mule comes from.
Yeah, I was just going to say. I was wondering.
Very famous phrase from the Reconstruction era. Yeah, this is 40 acres was kind of like the minimum amount of land you could have to have a viable farm. At least it was considered to be the case. This order later is going to be rescinded by President Andrew Johnson, but for a while at least, things are looking good for these former slaves. They actually get some land, and they're able to raise crops, but sadly, that's going to come to an end within just a couple of years.
All right. Well, his march is not over, so...
Oh, no. He's just getting started.
Tell me about the next march.
All right. So one interesting thing that happens is that some congressman, I forget who it was, but that he introduces a bill to make Sherman the same rank as Grant. There's a lot of people who are still anti-Grant. We've talked about how there were some politicians and other Northern leaders who didn't like Grant and tried to get him drummed out of the service. And Lincoln repeatedly said, "Hey, I can't let this guy go. He fights. You know, this is a guy that fights." There was a famous quote where somebody complained about somebody complained about Grant's drinking. And Lincoln supposedly said, "Well, I'd like to find out what brand of whiskey he drinks so I can send it to all of my generals."
Yeah, his drinking liability was now seen as an asset.
Yeah, and of course, that was way overblown anyway. But but Sherman is very loyal to Grant. He's friends with Grant, and Sherman refuses it. He says, "I don't want the promotion. Grant deserves to be the number one general. He deserves to be the only lieutenant general in the entire army." So this is one of the few times in history that a military officer is offered a promotion and turns it down. Not the only time, but it's certainly notable in because it's so rare. All right, the next few weeks, Sherman rests his army around Savannah. The army gets reinforcements, and it grows to 100,000. And the people of South Carolina begin to shake in their boots because South Carolina, as we all know, is just north of Georgia. They're next. In late January, Sherman kicks off and marches through South Carolina, and this is beginning to be a little personal. You know, in Georgia, to quote one of the mafia guys, I think that was this Marlon Brando in The Godfather, "It's not business, it's personal." No, it's the other way around. I'm sorry. It's not personal. It's business.
It's personal. It's business.
Yeah, leave it to me to blow the quote. I'm not big on mafia movies. But so in Georgia, it wasn't personal. It was business. But now in South Carolina, it is personal because, as we all know, South Carolina was the hotbed of rebellion. This is where secession began. They were the first state to go out of the Union. One officer actually wrote in a letter, here is where treason began, and by God, here is where it will end. So if Georgia had it tough, South Carolina is going to have it even tougher. Now, one thing that works against Sherman on this march is that the weather was awful. It rains just about every other day on average. But Sherman says, okay, fine, if we don't have roads, we're going to make roads. So the army cuts down trees, and they make corduroy roads. We've talked about these before. Sherman, of course, is not the first person to use these. This is where you just lay down a bunch of logs, and you can march across them. You can get wagons across them. It's not great, but it's a lot better than mud that you get stuck in. And so they just build road after road after road, and they just go right along. Sherman doesn't let the weather be a problem at all. And as I mentioned, the army is even more destructive in South Carolina than in Georgia. And despite the terrible weather, Sherman's army advances 10 to 12 miles per day. Joseph Johnston, who by now is in North Carolina, he hears of Sherman's progress, and he said there had been no such army in existence since the day of Julius Caesar. And that's quite a compliment, isn't it, Scott?
Wow.
There had been a heck of a lot of armies in existence, but not like this.
I would put him in the pantheon of top three military strategists who've ever lived. Caesar, not Sherman, but so that's quite a compliment.
It really is. Yeah, he's maybe a little bit exaggerating, but the point is that Sherman is blowing everybody away by his progress and just amazing people. Charleston, South Carolina, where it all began, it surrenders on February 18th. The city of Columbia, which is the capital of South Carolina, was burned to the ground. And to this day, there's controversy about who is responsible. A lot of pro-Southern people said, oh, Sherman's fault. The Yankees burned it down. Northern people, apologists say, no, the South, they actually burned it themselves to deny the goods and the supplies to the Union Army. The truth, from what I've been able to ascertain from most scholars, is somewhere in between. In other words, the Confederates set some of the fires on their way out, but the Union didn't always try real hard to put them out, and they probably burned some of the stuff themselves. So it was really both sides, but Columbia is absolutely devastated. And Sherman's army doesn't stop. They keep going. They march into North Carolina. And there on March 20th, now we're into 1865, by the way. On March 19th to 21st, he fights the Battle of Bentonville against a small army, 22,000 or so under Joseph Johnston, and the Federals drive the rebels back. And we will leave Sherman there. I'm going to talk a little about the outcome. We'll briefly see how that comes out, the Sherman versus Johnston. Once again, those two are squaring off, but now they're in North Carolina. But let me say this, that Sherman's capture of Atlanta and his marches destroyed hundreds of millions of dollars of Confederate property and supplies. They greatly demoralized the Southern people. And, of course, the marches were an overwhelming success. Sherman marched 650 miles in fewer than 100 days, marching days. They captured three state capitals, and they lost fewer than 600 men from the original army of 60,000, which later grew to 100,000. So one of the most brilliant campaigns and amazingly successful campaigns in military history. And it really, really does a 1-2-3 punch to the South and really knocks the wind out of them.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. Chumba. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And I'd like to just give some numbers to what you said. You mentioned that there was an estimated $100 million worth of damage with the March to the Sea. So how this breaks down, these are just a few things, but the Union Army wrecks 300 miles of railroad lines, bridges, miles of telegraph lines. Remember, this is the 1860s, so we're getting into the age of instantaneous communications. They seize 5,000 horses, 4,000 mules, 13,000 head of cattle. This is where they're feasting. They confiscate 10 million pounds of corn, 10 million pounds of fodder.
That's amazing.
They destroy. I guess that if you have to feed an army, but they destroy cotton gins, mills, the economic backbone of the South. It'd be like today if you were torching server farms for Google. If I could think of what a cotton gin would be in the 21st century sense. So what he does, I mean, Sherman, what he accomplishes is amazing because he's going against conventional wisdom of the day. He goes against military principles by going deep into enemy territory without communication lines, without supply lines. But like you said, James, he destroys the South's potential, the motivation to be able to wage war. And the Confederate war effort is completely knocked to pieces. If you're Jefferson Davis and you're trying to or Robert E. Lee, and you're trying to imagine any sort of strategy, I don't know what you could imagine outside of divine providence, some sort of Old Testament story of an archangel coming up and destroying the enemy army. I don't know what else you could hope for at this point to even imagine some sort of victory.
Yeah, and here's the problem too for Lee and the Confederates is that Grant's coming down, he's constantly punching them from the north. And now here comes Sherman. He's gone through Georgia. He's gone through South Carolina. Now he's coming up into North Carolina. He's going to come up from the south. And he'd been, you know, as we saw, he'd lost very few people. His army is well fed. They're tired, of course, but they're well fed. Their morale is really high. Lee is about to be caught in a pincher. You know, he's got, again, Grant pushing down from the north, and Sherman's about to be pushing up from the south. So major problems.
All right. Well, this is the ninth battle, the Battle of Atlanta and the March of the Sea. So battle number 10, where does that take us in the next episode?
We are going to now go back to the east and focus on what happens after General Grant moves to the east and takes command of the Army of the Potomac. At least for all intents and purposes, he becomes the commander of the Army of the Potomac. And we're going to see how Grant is going to come up with his own personal strategy to pound Lee into submission. He's going to begin a campaign of not just attack, 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 but also quite a bit of maneuvering. He's trying to, number one, defeat Lee's army, and number two, get to Richmond and hopefully capture the Confederate capital. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and one other thing, too, before we finish up, is there's an episode in this feed where I spent about 40 minutes comparing Grant to Lee, and I recommend checking that out before the next episode. I look at a lot of different characteristics, the command style, how clear their orders are, different factors to what many think spell Grant's victory and then Lee's defeat. So I recommend checking that out to see how these two generals size up and compare with one another. But anyway, we'll return to the East in the next episode and see how the Civil War begins to wrap up. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, and Melissa Sarnowski. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.